content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine's February 23, 2026 edition. Bordered in red, the front cover is, as usual, with an inner border of white. Time is spelled in T-I-M-E, large block, capital lettering in white, upon a gradated blue background. The top portion of the front cover is in a bright blue, like a winter blue sky. And by the time we reach the bottom of the front page photograph, it looks like fog or a cloud out of which are walking or running or striding five officers dressed not exactly in camouflage gear, although some wear components of that, but in combat gear. They have jackets, pants, vests. Some wear police in a stenciled fabric across the front of the vest. All are wearing helmets of some kind. All are carrying firearms of some kind. I'm wondering if they're walking through a fog created by some type of gas that has been implemented. In the middle background, some trees defoliated. So this is leading Minneapolis, the siege of an American city. That will be one of the items I read to you coming up. The first one, however, is the brief news. Good question. Does your baby qualify for a $1,000 Trump account? By Callum Sutherland. President Donald Trump has touted his Trump accounts as a way to give every newborn American child a financial stake in the future. At a U.S. Treasury event January 28, with a sign proclaiming Trump accounts jumpstart the American dream, and an appearance by rapper Nicki Minaj, who referred to herself as the president's number one fan, he broke down how that stake will manifest and who gets a cut of it. Now, the stake is spelled S-T-A-K-E. Trump informed the crowd that the government would seed each account with a one-time contribution of $1,000. Others can add up to $5,000 annually per child. He claimed that with modest contributions, the value of each pot should reach a total of at least $50,000 by the time the child reaches adulthood. According to the Trump account's website, the $1,000 bonus will be given to each baby born from January 1, 2025 to December 28, 2028, a period that roughly coincides with Trump's second presidential term. Children born before 2025 will not be eligible for the $1,000 newborn bonus, but parents can still set them up with accounts if the child has a valid Social Security number. Funds will be invested in the stock market, specifically a diversified portfolio of low-cost index funds designed to maximize long-term growth while minimizing risks. These funds can then be accessed without penalty for qualified expenses such as education, buying a first home, or starting a business. Some other withdrawals may be subject to restrictions and taxed at ordinary income rates, but the Trump administration has yet to expand upon these restrictions. Parents can sign up to receive further updates via the official website. The initiative was first suggested by a House GOP group. the Money Accounts for Growth and Advancement Act, or MAGA Act, proposed a $1,000 tax-free benefit to qualifying American kids. The Trump Accounts proposal was refined in June and then included in the One Big Beautiful Bill, which was signed into law in July. At the January event, Trump also credited that measure with the largest tax cuts in American history. Per the Tax Foundation think tank, it was the ninth largest tax cut in the U.S. since 1940, but said the Trump accounts were, to him, probably the most consequential part of the bill. Parents are currently able to enroll their child by filing the newly created IRS Form 4547. Following enrollment, a financial institution will receive your funds and activate your account. Accounts will be open for further contributions upon the official launch of the initiative July 5. Claiming that these tax-deferred investment accounts will chart the path to prosperity for a generation of American kids, the White House has centered the initiative as a key component of its approach to affordability amid the ongoing cost-of-living crisis. While the White House heralds the accounts as a sign of success, Trump referred to it as one of the most transformative policy innovations of all time. Some experts have raised concerns. In an article for Time in December, Stanford economists Neil Mahoney and Adam Shaw argued Trump accounts will disproportionately benefit well-off Americans. The program may be open to every child, but its benefits will flow overwhelmingly to families with the means to contribute thousands of dollars a year, they noted. Should parents contribute the maximum $5,000 yearly on top of the baseline $1,000, each fund is estimated to be valued at $303,800 by the time a child turns 18, based on historical averages of the S&P 500 index. At the January event, Trump highlighted philanthropic commitments meant to balance some of that difference. He thanked billionaires Michael and Susan Dell, celebrating them for donating $6.25 billion to the project, earmarked for kids in low-income zip codes, and investor Ray Dalio, who pledged to donate $250 per child for approximately 300,000 kids under age 10 in Connecticut. Trump also announced investor Brad Gerstner had pledged to provide $250 for each child under 5 with a Trump account in Indiana. This president is voracious in his desire to hear from America's leaders about how to make America better, said Gerstner at the launch event. This is citizen democracy at its best. From the Milestones page, there's just one lengthier article, followed by 2, 4, 5 short sketches. Remembrance, Catherine, with a C, O'Hara, Singular Comedic Talent, by Michael Keaton, who is an Emmy-winning, Academy Award-nominated actor. 2 years ago, Oscar night. Backstage, Catherine O'Hara and I have mere minutes before we walk out to present, and we're riffing on how to make a funny entrance. She says, how about when they introduce us, you go out real fast without waiting for me, and I'll go, hey, wait. Yeah, I like that. Let's do that, I say. Ladies and gentlemen, here to present, we enter. Do the bit. Crickets. Mostly. To this day, I replay it in my head, feeling like I let her down. Did I not sell it enough? Was I too subtle? Too real? I literally redo the walk in my mind, trying to make it work. With almost anyone else, I'd have forgotten it within seconds, but with her, it was not about the joke landing. It was because I liked her so damn much. To work comedically with Catherine, as I was lucky to get to do, not just at the awards show, but on two Beetlejuice movies and projects like The Paper and Game 6 across nearly 40 years, was like breathing rarefied air. And between takes, it was the greatest hang-on set. The only thing better was the hang-off set, in real life, as I call it. When she talked to you, she talked with you. When you told her a story, she looked right at you and was all in. A twinkle, a light, a glow. I don't know what the hell it was. To make her laugh was such a joy. We had made tentative plans to get together in January. She and her husband, Beau, were going to come over to the house for dinner. I'm still kind of waiting. Since her unthinkable passing at 71, January 30, I mostly managed to avoid any clips of her on my phone or TV, but I got blindsided by one that popped up. Could not avoid it. I watched. I felt sad. I turned off the light and closed my eyes to sleep. 4 minutes later, I woke up to the sound of laughing. It was me. I smiled and fell back asleep. To have a woman as your friend is a great thing. To have a brilliantly funny woman as your friend is special. To have Catherine O'Hara as your friend is a blessing. Among so many great comedians, past and present, Catherine stood out. Comedically, gold. As a person, platinum. I'll have dinner with Beau. You have laughs with John Candy. The brief news, world. Young adults in China are learning to live alone by Miranda Jayaratnam. Tired from work and craving a sweet treat or a spa day, young people in China have a new mantra for that, Ai Ni Laoji. The phrase meaning love you, dear friend, took off on Chinese social media at the end of last year as users tacked it onto videos, posts, and comments to justify spending on the dearest friend of them all, themselves. It is a familiar concept to many outside China. Through the 2010s, Western social media was inundated with the phrases treat yourself, popularized by the sitcom Parks and Recreation, and YOLO, you only live once, and the concept of self-care has powered a booming wellness industry. But the Chinese phrase reflects a starker shift in the nation of 1.4 billion, where older generations have long emphasized hard work and personal sacrifice, and where younger generations are now struggling to build lives according to those traditional expectations amid rapid urbanization and a sluggish job economy. Memes like Ai Ni Laoji resonate because of their irony, says Sylvia Zhu, a 25-year-old from Beijing who now lives in Seattle. Many of the stories people share online are about struggling in life and slowly getting through it by relying on yourself, which many young people in China can relate to, she says, adding that some of her friends have also started saying, life is too short, or you never know what will happen tomorrow. Xu says she and her friends in China enjoy spending on things for themselves, like pop marts, viral Labadoo dolls, personal luxuries like handbags, or hobby-related gear like camera lenses. After I started working, I realized that to keep life feeling exciting, material things sometimes play a role, Zhu says. If it's something you can afford, it is often seen as a self-reward. The mentality is just one example of how young people in China are adapting to a fast-changing and often atomizing Urban Society. Ashley Dudaranok, who runs a consumer research consultancy based in mainland China and Hong Kong, tells Time these trends among China's Gen Z are a rational response to a hyper-competitive job market, stagnant wages, and rising costs of living. When traditional markers of success like marriage and home ownership become structurally inaccessible for many, young people are forced to redefine what a good life means, Dudaranok says. If they cannot afford a house, they can at least afford to treat themselves to a nice meal or a Pop Mart toy that brings them joy. Chinese families have traditionally lived close to each other, at times with several generations under one roof. But in recent decades, many Chinese people, especially members of younger generations, have left their homes in rural areas to live and work in big cities. China has more than 130, with populations above 1 million and 18 above 10 million. The country has seen a dramatic rise in people living alone, with more than 100 million single-person households, according to an annual report from the National Bureau of Statistics of China in 2024. The numbers projected to reach 150 million to 200 million by 2030. That reality has also fueled a surge of products and services catering to people living alone, including more restaurants catering to solo diners and a fast-growing market in pets, even AI pets. Rapid urbanization and the rise of the digital economy have created a new social landscape, says Dudaranok. The Chinese government has taken steps to regulate AI companions amid global concern over AI-fueled psychotic delusions and self-harm. The move, Dudaranok adds, is recognition that these new forms of companionship and social interaction are becoming a permanent feature of Chinese society. The app Sai Lima, Are You Dead Yet, drew global attention recently as it became one of the most downloaded in China. It has just one function. Users tap a button on their phones every day as virtual proof of life for their social networks. If a user fails to do so for two consecutive days, the app automatically sends an email to a chosen emergency contact. To Zhu, who lives across the globe from her family, the app's popularity is proof that social isolation has become an accepted reality. The idea of living and dying alone may be most closely associated with the elderly, but the app is largely marketed to the young. It reflects a sense that young people also feel they could die at any time while living alone, and that because of isolation, friends or family might not notice or do regular wellness checks, Zhu says. Rather than making me feel more secure, it shows how lonely and disconnected modern life can be, even for people who are young. The app addresses a phenomena that is not unique to China, underscored by its popularity in places like Singapore, the UK, India, the Netherlands, and the US, where it is listed under the name Damumu and by a wave of copycat apps. Some netizens say that the "Are You Dead" greeting feels like a carefree joke between close friends. It is both heartfelt and gives a sense of unguarded ease, writes writer Hei Tao, who observed in a commentary for Yikai, the Chinese business network, a state-owned media group. It likely explains why so many young people unanimously like this app. Whether or not young people in China are actually concerned about a premature death, he wrote, the app's success serves as a darkly humorous social metaphor, reminding us to pay attention to the living conditions and inner world of contemporary young people. Those who downloaded it clearly need more than just a functional security measure. They crave a signal of being seen and understood. The individualism taking form among Chinese youth is different from the rugged, self-reliant individualism often associated with the West, Dudaranoc says. Chinese youth are not necessarily breaking from their families or culture, but they're carving out more space for personal expression and emotional needs within those structures. Lunar New Year, which begins this year, February 17, is the most significant holiday in China, and it has historically centered on family and relatives. That view has not changed among young people, according to a 2025 survey by Just So Soul, the research arm of Chinese social networking app Soul. But some of their ways of celebrating it have. More than a third of the nearly 6,000 respondents said they spend more time socializing online than in person during the holiday, and digital traditions like sending virtual hongbaos or red packets and celebrating with Cyper relatives, group chats, online communities, and even influencers whom young people digitally visit during the festive period have become more popular. The tradition's still there, but the social unit has shifted from family to chosen communities, says Zhu. It's less about rejecting tradition and more about reshaping it. The self-care memes are just another example of how young people are rewriting traditional values. For older generations, self-love had to be earned, Sheng Yuli wrote about the trend in an op-ed for state-owned Chinese magazine Sixth Tone. If you wanted to treat yourself, you'd better first finish the project, get a promotion, or reach your weight loss goals, Zhang wrote. But among China's younger generations, regardless of your success, Lao Ji still deserves compassion, is still worth that milk tea or hot pot, and is still allowed an afternoon of doing nothing. Familial expectations are still there, Zhu says. The survey notes young people, especially young women, find themselves overwhelmed by questions about their careers or marriage at family gatherings during the Lunar New Year. The country's birth rate fell 17% last year to the lowest level since 1949. When the People's Republic of China was established, in spite of government efforts to encourage couples to have children. But increasingly, those pressures are butting heads with an economic reality that's pushing many young people to reconsider what success means for them. A growing lie-flat movement of young people in China appeals to those choosing a low-desire life, moving out of big cities to more rural areas or even out of the country, and rejecting the common grueling work hours of 9-9-6 or 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. For Zhu's parents, success means stability. Owning a home, having a stable career, getting married, raising children. But for her, it is different. For me, she says, success is more about personal fulfillment and mental well-being. Having financial independence, time for hobbies, meaningful relationships, and a sense of freedom. Here's the cover story, The Occupation of Minneapolis, Scenes from a City Under Siege. There is a photograph here, full page, by Aaron Treib for Time. It's a snowy scene. In the background, there's a house standing in a yard that is snow-covered. The trees are bare. In the middle foreground is a street. It looks like it might be slick. It might be icy or snow-packed. I can't quite tell because there are various shades of gray in this concrete slab. On that street are two people, apparently No, I'm not going to say it's a man and a woman. It's a taller person and a shorter person. And they're hugging each other, and they are dressed for winter with heavy-looking quilted coats. One's a jacket and one's a longer coat. One, at least, is wearing boots. I can't see the other's feet because of debris in front of the feet. Both are wearing stocking caps. Both are wearing gloves, or maybe one is wearing mittens. And in front of that, in the foreground, it looks like a little bit of a debris field. There are flags. One is definitely the U.S. flag. Another may be the state of Minnesota flag. They're colorful, at any rate. And then strewed along the ground next to the flags are flowers, bunches of flowers. Some look bright and fresh. Others look like they're in the decaying mode, perhaps frozen by the outside temperatures. There are a couple of cans that perhaps were used as vases at one time. The ground, it doesn't look grassy. It looks brown and, yeah, it just looks brown, like it's not covered by any ground cover. But this is the occupation of Minneapolis. This is long, so I might be abridging it. And there are a couple more photos. Here's another one of a house on a snow-covered yard with a sign in front. There's a bare leaf tree in front and a sign that says, "Everyone's welcome except ice." I-C-E. Here's a person, an individual, again bundled up with a jacket and gloves and a stocking cap, standing in front of a brick building on a grassy, but it's dormant, grassy lawn. Amanda Otero stands sentry with a whistle outside her child's school. She's in a group of more than 1,000 volunteers monitoring for ice across dozens of schools. This feels like a pretty massive collective generational trauma, she says. It's not something folks will recover from overnight. Julia Taruso writes, "Minneapolis is deep into its brutal winter, but the city is anything but still. After 3,000 federal immigration agents were deployed here, that is Minneapolis, in early December, residents organized to thwart them. Neighbors march, monitor school drop-offs, raise money for families too afraid to work. Signal chats buzz with reports of suspected ICE activity. Whistles cut through the air, warning agents are nearby. The lives of immigrants have shrunk. Businesses lock up. Parents sign contingency paperwork in case they're detained. Children carry passports in their backpacks." Long before Sanctuary City was a political epithet, area churches were sponsoring refugees from wars in Laos and Somalia. George Floyd's murder challenged a welcoming place to grapple with race and policing in America. Now the nation's clash over immigration enforcement unfolds block by block. Turning the page to Man in the Middle, under the heading Nation, again by Julia Taruso, Minneapolis, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein, New York. Mayor Jacob Frey is navigating Trump's immigration crackdown. How he is doing that. Here's a photo, full page. The mayor at his city hall office, January 26. It's a young-looking man. He has brown, kind of wavy hair, well-groomed, dark eyes. Looks like either what's called olive or a light tan skin color, wearing a gray suit and a blue shirt, and he's looking concerned. Jacob Frey, and that's spelled F-R-E-Y, had just helped his 5-year-old daughter into her ballet slippers at dance class when Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara called. Federal agents had shot someone, O'Hara told the mayor. It was bad. It was Saturday morning, January 24, a few miles away, an ICU nurse named Alex Pretty, P-R-E-T-T-I, had been shot to death across from a donut shop on Nicollet Avenue, the second American citizen in 3 weeks, killed by federal agents in this city under siege. Fry rushed for his coat, arranged for another parent to take his daughter home after class, and darted out the door. "I didn't say goodbye, which I felt really bad about," he recalls in an interview in his City Hall office. Fry, 44, is in his third term as mayor of Minneapolis, a tenure marked by an almost unfathomable series of tragedies. 2 years after he took office, COVID crippled the city's downtown. Then came George Floyd's murder by a Minneapolis cop, catalyzing protests and riots. A painful fight over police reform, a depletion in the department's ranks. Last June, 2 Democratic state legislators in the Minneapolis suburbs were shot along with their spouses in what authorities called an act of targeted political violence. In August, 2 children were killed and more than 24 others were injured in a shooting at a school mass at the city's Annunciation Catholic Church. The current Immigration and Customs Enforcement occupation was preceded by a scandal involving the defrauding of social service programs that put the city under the MAGA movement's microscope, which many, including Fry, believe figured in the Trump administration's decision to make Minneapolis the focus of the largest federal immigration enforcement deployment in American history. Operation Metro Surge, launched in December, has brought some 3,000 agents, many heavily armed, masked, dressed in tactical gear, to this frozen city of lakes, often tailed by protesters wielding cell phones, documenting their aggressive tactics. Photos showed Liam Conejo Ramos, a 5-year-old in a blue bunny cap, being taken into federal custody. Video captured a woman on her way to a medical appointment, dragged from her car, her seatbelt slashed as she struggled. Protesters have been manhandled, pepper sprayed at close range, enveloped in plumes of tear gas. At some schools, absenteeism jumped as high as 40%. Immigrant-owned businesses pull down their gates as sales plummet and workers stay home. Residents monitor preschools, log unfamiliar ICE license plates, and gather in protest, trying in ways big and small to help their neighbors. Fry's at the center of it all, caught between a president who casts him as a radical leftist, defying federal authority, and a progressive city of 430,000 that wants him to do more to resist immigration, crack down, and regain control. Fry's governing creed, forged in the crucible of previous crises, is that resistance is most effective when it's deliberate and restrained. Part of the pushback is showing that we can have democratically run cities that can work, he says, picking up trash, de-icing alleyways, removing graffiti, filling in potholes. He has given fiery speeches demanding that ICE get the F-space CK out after Renee Good was killed by an ICE agent in early January. But in some ways, his performance demonstrates the limits of his powers. A reprieve appears to be coming, with polls showing a growing majority of Americans believe ICE has gone too far. The DOJ opened a civil rights probe into Pretty's death. President Trump softened his tone and swapped out the aggressive commander of the Minneapolis operation for his border czar, Tom Homan, who announced a partial drawdown of federal forces, but a sizable number of agents will remain. "There's a very straightforward antidote, and that is to leave," Fry told me. "They leave. Those businesses have customers again. They leave, and fear is reduced on the street. But, of course, this is not about safety. this is not even about immigration. This is a political narrative they're trying to concoct. Minneapolis is not the first city to contend with the consequences of Trump's immigration crackdown, but it has become the clearest warning of what a mass deportation campaign that aims to remove 1 million people from the U.S. each year can look like on the ground, and of the reckoning awaiting more of America's mayors and citizens when the federal government turns its power inward. I first met Fry on an icy Wednesday morning as he dropped his two girls off at daycare. The mayor helped his five-year-old daughter step carefully along a frozen sidewalk as he toted his six-month-old baby in her carrier. It is often the one time of day he gets to see his kids, and he lingers inside with them for a few minutes before wishing them a good day. Riding to City Hall in his black Escalade, the mayor reflected on the latest attack from the president. The day before, Fry had a call with Trump that he describes as pretty collegial. But then Fry reiterated on X that the city's roughly 600 police officers would not participate in immigration enforcement. I don't want them spending a second hunting down a father, dropping his kids off at daycare, who is about to go to work a 12-hour shift, he tells me. In response, Trump had launched another broadside that morning, saying Fry was playing with fire. The warning was an attempt at coercion, Fry says, a nod to the federal subpoena he'd been served as part of a Department of Justice investigation. Fry is a Minneapolis transplant, a former professional distance runner from Virginia. He fell in love with the city's trails and lakes and moved there in 2009 to practice employment and civil rights law. In 2011, he helped organize the first Big Gay Race, a charity event to raise money for marriage equality. 2 years later, he was elected to the city council. He did not have a legacy here, says council member Linnea Palmisano, an ally of the mayor's. He's always had to be his own self-made man. Fry campaigned as a unifier, pledging to mend the city's divisions and becoming the second youngest mayor in Minneapolis history and second Jew to hold the office. Colleagues saw a leader with boundless energy and a desire to talk to people who disagreed with him. The unity appeal collided with the turmoil that befell the city after Floyd's murder, which led to a protracted fight over the future of policing in Minneapolis. Fry opposed calls to defund the police, a position that was unpopular on the left at the time. The critics from back then are on him again now, except this time many are urging him to have local police act more proactively to protect residents from ICE's excesses and to hold the line on non-cooperation with DHS. For all the attention Fry's received for his impassioned public defense of the city, in person he's cautious, pausing carefully to choose his words. In the mayor's third-floor office suite, thick stacks of printed talking points sit on desks. Around a conference table at City Hall, Fry convenes a morning meeting. He asks O'Hara, the police chief, dialing in on Zoom, for the latest intel on ICE operations. The chief reports a slight decrease in activity, then recounts a few unconfirmed rumors. One is that a federal agent staked out a home with a hostile sign in the window. Another alleges that an agent impersonated a volunteer at a food distribution center. Police were also called to a hotel housing ICE officers where protesters had gathered to make noise outside. City leaders have no comprehensive way of tracking Department of Homeland Security activity. Much of the information they have about the ongoing federal operation arrives the same way it does for local residents, via viral videos, social media posts, and word of mouth. Fry and his team try to keep track of incidents by following the frenetic stream of 911 calls and dispatches from the independent trackers who blanket the city in organized neighborhood groups. Hundreds are coordinating across more than a dozen separate signal chats. Residents are encouraged to report incidents of suspected DHS abuse to a state attorney's general website. The mayor's staff of 15 has been bombarded by some 30,000 constituent complaints in the past 2 months. Some have received threatening messages prompting the office to remove their contact information from the city's website. The hub of community resistance has been the Whipple Federal Building, where people detained by ICE are held in crowded cells. Some report an absence of access to food, water, or medical care. On a freezing Thursday morning, a small band of locals, a music teacher, a retired veteran, a grandmother of three, stood shoulder to shoulder, screaming, "Shame and traitor," as agents drove in and out of the facility in unmarked cars. Fry has not visited the demonstrations at Whipple, and while he joined thousands of locals marching in a recent ICE Out protest, the self-described pragmatic progressive has drawn criticism from liberals on the city council, some of whom are helping to organize the resistance movement. "I personally have never seen or heard or seen him out in the streets," says Elizabeth Bonin, communications coordinator for the Twin Cities Democratic Socialists of America group, which opposed Fry in November's election. "Our community is out here every day watching over the streets, making sure kids get to school safely. We're delivering groceries to neighbors. We're printing whistles on people's 3D printers. We're raising money to pay rent because our system of government has failed us." There's a small inset graphic here with an outline of the state of Minnesota and Minneapolis starred. Minneapolis is in the southeastern third of the state, which is fairly narrow and tall. And then within Minneapolis, here's a circle, downtown Minneapolis. Interstate 94 then is to the south of downtown, and south of that is where Alex Pretty was shot on Nicollet Avenue, and Renee Good was shot on Portland Avenue, near something called Powderhorn Park. Interstate 35 West bisects those two sections of the south of Minneapolis, and further south then is George Floyd Square. Back to the text. After the meeting with city officials, Fry visits the 24 Somali Mall, a shopping center filled with vendors, many of them citizens who've lived here decades, selling everything from rugs to electronics to tax services. These days, it's about 50% vacant. Dozens of immigrant business owners are too fearful to go to work. Others have shuttered shops because of decreased foot traffic. But as word spread, the mayor was paying a visit, Fry was swarmed. People called his name and grabbed his arms, sharing a chorus of concerns. "No one's coming. People are scared. When will they leave?" "We're working on it," Fry tells them as he buys tea and samosas. Minnesota has the largest Somali community in the U.S., and Fry has worked to ingratiate himself. He's picked up some of the language. His older daughter can count to five in Somali. He bristles at what he sees as the precipitating reason for Operation Metro Surge, the sprawling scandal in which, as of January, 64 people, most of whom are of Somali descent, had been convicted of taking state and federal funding for phony social service programs. A former senior policy aide of Fry's was among those arrested. For Trump, the scandal presented a political opportunity. Minnesota's a blue state. Republicans have sought to put into play in presidential elections, led by a governor who was on the 2024 Democratic ticket. And the chaos that engulfed Minneapolis after Floyd's killing made it a national symbol of Black Lives Matter movement. A historic immigration enforcement operation in a city a fraction of the size of Chicago or Los Angeles, one with a lower than average proportion of undocumented immigrants, does not make much sense till you consider how it intersects with themes of democratic mismanagement and crimes committed by foreigners. Look, the fraud is real, Fry says, but you do not hold an entire community accountable for the actions of the criminal. Latino businesses have been hit hard. The Lake Street Corridor, a commercial and cultural artery, is quiet. Rebuilding a sense of security will take time, even after the federal footprint decreases, Fry says. People need to have confidence leaving their home that they're going to come back to it. Critics say Fry needs to do more to support the city in the meantime. The mayor's good at translating the surreal reality on the ground for cameras, says council member Robin Wansley, who's urging Fry to back an eviction moratorium. But that's not translating to what is a clear, coordinated plan of how he's using the city's reservoir of resources to show up in this moment. Later that afternoon, Fry escorts 22 new Police Academy grads down the aisle of the opulent Basilica of St. Mary in downtown Minneapolis. Bagpipes echo through the church as the officers prepare to take the department's oath to protect and serve. The work ahead is not going to be easy, Fry tells the cadets. The bright lights, not just of this church, but of the world, will be directly on this department. Fry's efforts to rebuild trust between the department and the city ranks among his proudest accomplishments. We have done a lot of work over these last 5 years, Fry says. The good news is it is being recognized. The bad news is that trust is also fragile. The department lost roughly 300 officers in the aftermath of Floyd's killing, as progressives called for its abolition, and a federal civil probe found a pattern of discrimination and unconstitutional policing. Meanwhile, each video clip of immigrants, demonstrators, or bystanders being harassed, and in some cases assaulted, by federal agents deepens a perception that federal authority is being wielded indiscriminately, and local leaders are powerless to stop it. Under the direction of Fry and O'Hara, Minneapolis police have adhered to the city's separation ordinance, which dictates they avoid involvement in immigration enforcement. Part of this is ideology. Minneapolis is a sanctuary city, but it's also an issue of limited capacity. For now, Fry's managed to navigate the challenges of the city's parallel police presences, says former police chief Medaria Arredondo. But if people witness their rights being violated by members wearing these federal uniforms, and members of the MPD are not stepping in and intervening and protecting them, Arredondo says, it is not going to matter which uniform they're seeing. The day after we met, Fry traveled to Washington to meet with fellow mayors in a gathering he called a needed therapy session. He cast his colleagues as defenders of the Republic at this precarious moment. We're on the front lines of a very important battle, he told them. If we do not speak up, if we do not step out, it will be your city that is next. That article, which was read in its entirety, was by Julia Taroso, Minneapolis, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein, New York. Next, the brief. The origins of an obsession, by Eric Cortalesa, how Greenland became both a prize and a marker in a world Trump is reordering. The photo, almost a full page, is in blues, blue sky in the background, tall snow-covered mountains in the middle ground, and a sprawling city, which is a coastal city, also snowy, in the foreground. Donald Trump's pursuit of Greenland started with an intelligence briefing in the Situation Room. It was early 2018, and a rising Russian submarine activity and the increased presence of Chinese vessels in the Arctic represented a security threat, Trump was told. At that meeting, according to a senior White House official at the time and a second person familiar with the conversation, Trump became preoccupied with the idea that the U.S. required a bigger and more permanent presence in Greenland because of its strategic location in the North Atlantic. That May, Trump was visiting Long Island for a political event when he met briefly with Ronald Lauder, a longtime friend and heir to the cosmetics fortune. Lauder told him Denmark was struggling economically and suggested the U.S. could leverage that strain to buy Greenland outright, according to the former White House official. When Trump's interest in buying Greenland was first reported that year, it struck critics as a characteristically provocative but unserious gambit, expansionist bluster from a president given to floating, outlandish ideas. But Trump was serious, nor was he the first commander-in-chief to entertain the idea. In the 19th century, William Seward, Secretary of State who negotiated the purchase of Alaska under Andrew Johnson, argued the case for acquiring Greenland was political and commercial, citing its vast territory and mineral wealth, but no offer was ever made. President Harry Truman revived the idea in 1949, at one point proposing to purchase the island from Denmark in exchange for $100 million in gold and oil rights in Alaska. What bothered Trump most, according to three sources close to him, was the sense the U.S. had already ceded power over Greenland once before. It was in the early 50s, 1950s, it built and operated Thule Air Base, now called Pituffik Space Base, largely as an American enclave central to missile defense and nuclear deterrence. During the Cold War, America exercised de facto control over Greenland for military purposes. Danish oversight was limited and largely nominal. When strategic imperatives collided with questions of sovereignty, American security priorities prevailed. But after the Cold War ended, the U.S. reduced its Greenland footprint, closing or consolidating installations while maintaining Thule as an outpost. Denmark reestablished political control of the base, even as it continued to rely on American security guarantees. When Trump learned this history, he thought the situation smacked of weakness, another case of the U.S. surrendering assets while European allies enjoyed the benefits. In discussions with friends and aides, he kept bringing Greenland up. First-term advisors say that it had not been for a litany of domestic distractions, the U.S. would have more aggressively pursued the purchase of Greenland then. The idea, however, stayed with Trump. Because of all the trials and tribulations of Trump 1.0, we never got there, says retired Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, a former top national security aide. Now we're there. In recent months, Trump has made the acquisition of the vast frozen island of a mere 56,000 people a sustained priority. He frames control of Greenland as a security imperative in an era of Arctic competition, warning that Russian militarization and Chinese commercial advances have left the U.S. exposed. he's threatened to apply economic pressure on Denmark and its allies, dangled the idea of using military force to seize the island before ruling it out, and installed informal emissaries to explore ways to gain permanent control of the island, or failing that, uncontested strategic access. The campaign so unsettled NATO allies that when Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney declared a rupture in the world order at the World Economic Forum, what leaped to mind was Greenland. Days later, Trump declared the framework of a deal with Danish officials had been reached. He offered no specifics, and two Danish sources tell Time the outline did not include U.S. control or ownership of the autonomous territory. Upcoming negotiations will test how far Trump is willing to go to get Greenland. But the president's fixation is bigger than control of the remote territory. It points to a broader ambition to redraw the architecture of American influence, loosen the constraints imposed by historic alliances, and anchor U.S. security policy in the Western Hemisphere. Greenland is a window into the animating logic of Trump's foreign policy, a determination to reorder the world to his liking, and to accomplish what others had contemplated and abandoned through the exercise of personal power. He's going to do what he wants to do, says Kellogg, and then everyone's got to follow. That last article was abbreviated because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.